Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. For decades, globalization has been a global mantra. Last week, in his inaugural address, President Donald Trump pushed back hard. America first, he said. Bring borders back. Last week in Davos, Switzerland, the great globalizers were still meeting. China's President Xi Jinping was loudly promoting free trade. What does globalization look like in the era of President Trump? Is it gone? This hour, On Point, in our 100-day spotlight, globalization in the time of Trump. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Do you agree with President Trump it's time to put America first? What does that mean for the role of the U.S. on the global stage, in globalization, in trade, and more? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Let's just remember, this was the president in his first speech, Inauguration Day.
From this day forward, a new vision will govern our land. From this day forward, it's going to be only America first. America first.
And standing there with the Capitol behind him, he got more specific, and it was tough.
Every decision on trade, on taxes, on immigration, on foreign affairs will be made to benefit American workers and American families. We must protect our borders from the ravages of other countries making our products, stealing our companies, and destroying our jobs.
Donald Trump on Inauguration Day. Joining me now from London via Skype is Martin Wolf, chief economics commentator for the Financial Times, London. He was at the World Economic Forum in Davos last week. Martin Wolf, welcome back to On Point. Great to have you here.
It's a pleasure.
And with me in the studio today is Ken Rogoff, professor of public policy and economics at Harvard University, also in Davos last week. Kenneth Rogoff, welcome to you as well.
Thank you. Always a pleasure.
Martin Wolf, what was the mood in Davos as the United States prepared to inaugurate Donald Trump with exactly the kind of view on the world that we just heard there?
Well, I suppose the general view was anxiety and a wonder, people wondering whether he really meant it. I suppose the inaugural address clarified that a bit more. Yes, he really does mean it. Though what precisely means, we will see. Among American business people, I think there was a notably more upbeat mood than among business people and policymakers from the rest of the world, because there was a belief, or at least an expressed belief among the Americans, that the tax cuts and the deregulation would bring huge benefits, or at least substantial benefits, to U.S. business. So within America, I felt, or among Americans, the mood was much more nuanced than it was in the rest of the world, where the dominant sense, I think, was anxiety.
Of course, President Trump moving right ahead. Just yesterday, he fulfilled a campaign promise, formally withdrew the United States from the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the TPP trade deal. Here's sound from a video of him signing that memorandum.
We're going to sign three memorandums right now. The first one is withdrawal of the United States from the Trans-Pacific Partnership.
Everyone knows what that means, right? We've been talking about this for a long time. Thank you. Okay. Great thing for the American worker, what we just did.
There it was, pen to paper. Meanwhile, in Davos last week, you had the president of China, Xi Jinping, and you can't draw direct lines necessarily, but there he was warning against protectionism.
Pursuing protectionism is just like locking oneself in a dark room, while wind and rain may be kept outside, so are light and air. No one will emerge as a winner in a trade war.
The president of China, Xi Jinping. Ken Rogoff with me in the studio here. Is globalization over?
Well, hardly. I mean, there have been retreats from globalization over the decades before, and particularly in the wake of the financial crisis, with, you know, some people hurting so much. It's not surprising. But I have to tell you, supporting what Martin just said about anxiety, mm-hmm. it's not just over Trump. It's over what's next. There are big elections coming up in Europe, particularly mm-hmm. in France, mm-hmm. where there's a far-right Marine Le Pen. She wants to pull France out of the European Union.
Frexit.
It would just blow up Europe. Netherlands, Germany, and everybody's saying, well, doesn't seem like the extremists are going to win, but that's what we thought in the UK with Brexit. That's what we thought with Trump. Who knows where things are going? So there's a deeper fear that there's this undercurrent of populism they don't understand, can't predict.
Martin Wolf, who are the extremists here? Donald Trump and perhaps Marine Le Pen and their populist ilk seem to suggest, I mean, you just heard the president right there in his first speech, Inauguration Day, saying our companies were stolen. Our jobs were stolen. It makes globalization sound like the extreme angle.
Well, there are two points. And I mean, extremism is always defined relative to one's own position. Mm. They probably think mm-hmm. themselves as quite moderate and reasonable. Mm. They're extreme from my position. But perhaps analytically, the more useful point is that policymaking for a very long time, we can discuss how far it goes back. In the West, I would say it began immediately after the Second World War, globally, probably in the 80s, has moved in the direction of the liberalization of international trade and also financial flows. So that's been a little bit more intermittent. It's certainly not been linear, but it has been fairly continuous. What we are now seeing are policymakers either in power or possibly about to be in power, including policymakers in the most important, or the policymaker in the most important country in the world, the US, saying that's all wrong and we want to go backwards. So that at the very least, it's a huge transformation. I think the argument that Mr. Trump has put forward about stealing our jobs and our factories, to me, that is an argument that just doesn't really make any sense. I don't know what stealing means in this context. What happened was the United States made the decision to open its economy. Other countries made the decision to open their economies. People freely bought these goods that were on sale. Nobody was involved in theft. Information and knowledge and know-how flowed across frontiers just as one hoped. And problems arose, which I think were dealt with very badly, notably in the US. But the rhetoric that Mr. Trump is using is, of course, deliberately adversarial and of course, is seen as such across the world.
Problems like what developed in the US? Martin,
well, obviously, the U.S. to an extreme degree has suffered from huge rises in inequality, much bigger than really in any other developed country. There seems to be some quite remarkable social phenomena. We're seeing this based on this now very famous paper by Case and Deaton on declining life expectancy for white men mm-hmm. and women in the U.S., something that doesn't seem to be happening anywhere else or indeed to other groups in the U.S. There is clearly a degree of anxiety which is extreme. But I would agree that there are other countries where much the same is happening, at least to some degree, associated with the ongoing process of deindustrialization, decline in employment in industry and manufacturing, which has been going on for a long time, which has certainly been accelerated by trade, though trade is not the only reason. And managing that is something that I would say most countries haven't done very well. But reversing it through protectionist policy, in my view, is impossible.
Ken Rogoff, what do you make of the kind of policies and posture that Donald Trump is laying on the table in his campaign and already in the first days of his time in office, talking with American manufacturers, automakers, and more, saying, stay here, we'll treat you great. Dare to take your factory abroad and try and sell it back here, we will bring a whole lot of pain down on you.
Well, let's get a fact on the table, which is that under 10% of U.S. workers are in manufacturing, and the idea that we're going to bring back a lot of manufacturing jobs makes about as much sense as that we're going to bring back a lot of agricultural jobs. Yes, globalization's accelerated, but it's technology. Has Mr. Trump been to modern product manufacturing facilities, even textiles, you don't see a lot of workers. We have actually increased manufacturing in the United States in recent years as a share of our income, but not the jobs. So the protectionism will drive costs up for consumers. It's not going to bring a lot of jobs back. And under a Trump presidency, I will confidently predict the number of manufacturing jobs is going to go down because there are these big technological trends.
Meaning automation will be kicking in no matter what he's doing?
Absolutely. Automation will kick in no matter what he's doing unless he tries to ban that too, and we can go on where that leads. So the idea that these policies are going to bring these jobs back is nonsense. When I was growing up, or certainly when I was a graduate student, there was a romanticism about agricultural jobs. You remember that? The American farmer, everything for the American farmer. Well, they've sort of forgotten. And they're very small, very well off. But now it's manufacturing. It's romanticism for this day gone by. It's not coming back.
You call it romanticism, but it was key to his election as president of the United States, and it was key to his opening address on the inauguration day. I mean, this is not just a fanciful idea. He's acting.
It's a political idea. So for a long time, you talk about let's help American farmers, and it got you votes, and now it's let's help American manufacturing workers. It gets you votes.
But he's in office, and he's already signed the TPP down.
Well, you know, what's unfortunate
maybe that's
is
right, but it's
most,
action.
Most of what we produce are services, you know, things like insurance, banking, engineering, and these trade agreements that he doesn't want to have, the TPP, were actually opening up trade agreements to services. They were helping our exports. And so the larger share of our economy is absolutely losing by not moving forward with these trade agreements.
I mean, that can sound like something that's easy to say when you're sitting at Davos with a nice drink. But for people who lost good-paying factory jobs, the service industry sounds like flipping burgers.
The vast majority of Americans are in service industry. It's only a small fraction in manufacturers. And yes, they're losing jobs. That's going to go on no matter what.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about globalization in the time of Trump. Last week, Donald Trump inaugurated President of the United States in Davos, Switzerland, kind of global center of globalization thinking. Well, that was going on as well. Eyes very much peeled toward the U.S. and Washington right now. You can join us this hour. What do you think? Is globalization, the sort of great wave, receding somehow? Is it over? Is there some reversal in the works here? Will the world be all about borders again? Everybody, every nation in it for themselves, in their castle? And what if the U.S. pulls back, but China doesn't, let's say, keeps on globalizing? Where does that leave things? Martin Wolf is with us, chief economics commentator for the Financial Times, joins us from London via Skype. Kenneth Rogoff. Ken Rogoff is here from Harvard University, big economist there. Here was Donald Trump with American business leaders yesterday, setting out his kind of ground rules, saying he's going to get manufacturing curbs from international trade right here, right now.
A company that wants to fire all of its people in the United States and build some factory someplace else, and then thinks that that product is going to just flow across the border into the United States, that's not going to happen. They're going to have a tax to pay, a border tax, a substantial border tax. Now, some people would say that's not free trade, but we don't have free trade now because we're the only one that makes it easy to come into the country.
Ken Rogoff, sounds like new borders to me. Sounds like walls.
Well, I want to underscore he has a point about, the difference between the U.S. and China. China has very free entry into the United States. Mm-hmm. They can buy U.S. companies. Not so easy for us to do the same here. So it's sort of difficult for people at Davos to parse out, is this a guy bargaining, saying, you know, I'm going to go to war with you if you don't open up.
Trade war.
Yeah. And you open up and all is good. It doesn't sound like it, but there are people who still have that optimism. And by the way, the Chinese are saying, you think you're going to have a trade war with us? We are not going to give into that. You're going to lose. They're hoping to strike a deal with him on other things, like maybe North Korea. We'll help more with North Korea. You give us trade.
Martin Wolf, what do you see unfolding here? Do you see globalization heading toward retreat? Do you see an era of protectionism rising before us or not?
Well, first of all, let me concur fully, because it's partly what something I said with what Ken said earlier, that there is no way that jobs in manufacturing are going to grow substantially as a result of protectionist actions. It's ultimately a false promise. But in terms of what's going to happen, it's perfectly possible to do an immense amount of damage, staggering amounts of damage, in the process of an unachievable goal. Now, my reading of what Mr. Trump said in the clip you just ran was that we will impose some sort of a tariff or tax on imports from factories that have been established abroad to produce things that used to be produced in the US. Now, making that happen is going to be incredibly difficult. It sounds almost as though it will be a firm-specific or company-specific trade policy, which is certainly almost impossible to work and entirely illegal under, as far as I know, every country's law, including U.S. domestic law, I would have thought. What happens, for example, if an American firm closes its plant, doesn't move the plant somewhere else, but simply purchases what it used to produce here in the U.S. or in my own country, the U.K., from another company's plant in another country? Is there then going to be this border tariff tax here? What happens if it's just a competitor in another country whose presence in the market closes down the U.S. company? Will it be taxed? Will it then be a tax on all imports of a particular category of goods? It's impossible fully to work out what is being intended here. Much of this, actually all of it, as far as I can see, would violate prior U.S. commitments, either in NAFTA or in the World Trade Organization or in other free trade agreements the U.S. has reached. Of course, it can try and renegotiate all these. But for that, it needs willing partners. Some partners will be more willing than others because they're weaker. If it tries to do this with the European Union or China, which are huge economic powers, there will be some very, very big problems indeed. And of course, if it ignores the rulings of the World Trade Organization against its actions, which are probably going to come along sometime, that will just make the US look, I can't really use another term, a rogue state. It will be a state violating its own international commitments. Then you finally ask, what would this mean for globalization? Well, that's, I think, a really good question. It's one I've just addressed in a column I've just finished, which is, if the US basically says, we are no longer bound by any of the agreements we've reached in the past, anything, we're going to do whatever we like, in any way we like, whatever the implications for international domestic law, then one of two things will happen. Either, which I think is quite possible, the rest of the world will go on and make agreements among itself. The US is a huge power, but it is only responsible for less than a fifth of world imports. There's a very large chunk of world trade that doesn't depend on the US. And I think the rest of the world might well decide, okay, the US is out of the system, we'll proceed. Or, of course, the whole system of rules that was created after the war will collapse and everybody it will be a free-for-all. And who knows what will happen then. But it is important to stress the US doesn't only have interests against imports. It also has export interests.
Yep.
And some of the very powerful manufacturing firms will be affected. One of the things China is likely to retaliate against is imports from the United States of civil aircraft, from Boeing.
Boeing. And watch out there. I want to get to Ken Rogoff for just a second. Forgive me, Martin, but Ken's got to jump in a minute. Ken Rogoff, do you see globalization winding down? If the U.S. opts out, does it become the odd man out? Does the world go on without it, or does the whole world sort of put up new walls and we're in a different dynamic entirely?
China's president came to the World Economic Forum, who's never come before, Davos, and said, you know what? The United States is out. We're in. And there's a much bigger question here than just trade. This is a system that has worked the United States. Yes, we need to redistribute income better. I think the tax cuts go in the other direction. Yes, we need to do more. But the U.S. is the richest country except for a few small countries. The U.S.
But a lot of Americans said, so what? It's not coming to us. We don't have the jobs. We're out here, as Martin reminded us, dying young.
when China starts controlling the Middle East, when China comes out with its aircraft carriers, when China's economy becomes bigger than us, people are going to be asking, how did we let this slip? We used to have the franchise. The U.S. truly used to be number one. So you can't just retreat into a shell, sort of be a France in a way. The United States is not in a position to do that.
Does globalization go forward without the United States if it does indeed retreat from that posture?
I don't know that it's going to be a simple process. Like I said, there are all these elections coming up in Europe, and then you can go around the world. There are countries like Turkey, Hungary that have autocrats going away from democracy, really, to some extent. So it's a very disconcerting period. But yes, in the long run, globalization will go ahead, but it might be a long time.
Did you hear self-examination in Davos? Wow, we blew it. Globalization was the way for so long, and now you've got an American president saying kind of no. Was there self-reflection? Where did we go wrong? How, among the globalizing elite, I guess Donald Trump would say.
Well, let's be clear. There's a question about, is Donald Trump right about his vision of how the world works in economics, and is he right politically? Well, he's proven he's right politically. There are a lot of doubts that what his ideas are going to go forward. And I think in the past, when there have been backsteps in globalization, retreats from globalization with these protectionist policies, and I must say Trump almost autocratic, picking out which firms lose, which firms win, it hasn't worked. And people have been worse off. It's changed. But we certainly seem like we're in for a period of that.
Ken Rogoff, professor of public policy, professor of economics at Harvard University, former chief economist at the International Monetary Fund, author of The Curse of Cash, and just back from Davos. Ken, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
Martin Wolf, stand by there in London. We had your prime minister, Theresa May, at the World Economic Forum in Davos last week. And here she was talking about the changing world. Theresa May.
International cooperation is vital, but we must never forget that our first responsibility as governments is to serve the people. And it is my firm belief that we, as governments, international institutions, businesses, and individuals, need to do more to respond to the concerns of those who feel that the modern world has left them behind.
And the British Prime Minister went on saying, people have a lot of fear around globalization these days.
Talk of greater globalization can make people fearful. For many, it means their jobs being outsourced and wages undercut. It means having to sit back as they watch their communities change around them.
Martin Wolf, chief economics commentator for the Financial Times in London, is with us this hour from London by Skype. With us from San Francisco, California right now is Jeff Ferry, economist, research director for the Coalition for a Prosperous America. It's a nonprofit. They work a lot on U.S. trade policy and maybe against so much globalization. He wrote a piece for The Hill recently headlined, Peter Navarro, Donald Trump's big economic advisor, is right. The trade deficit is a disaster for the U.S. economy. You can link to that at our website, onpointradio.org. Jeff Ferry, is Theresa May right that governments, it's time for governments to look to their own people and move away from globalization?
Hi, Tom. Nice to be here. Yes, I think Theresa May is absolutely right when she says globalization is a disaster, and that's why the British public voted for Brexit in June. And we're nonpartisan, but I've got to tell you, Donald Trump has been right when he said globalization is a disaster for the United States public as well. You know, globalization is sucking the lifeblood out of the American middle class, one decaf frappuccino at a time. In Brooklyn, San Francisco, and in Islington, they're debating what's their favorite craft beer and what's the right Latin American cuisine to dine on.
You mean the
week.
Communities that have prospered under globalization?
Right, right. Mm-hmm. There are lots of communities that have prospered because the sort of service jobs that are offered are doing well. But in the industrial heartland of the United States, we've seen massive unemployment, we've seen factories closing, and we've passed a very sad milestone where deaths from opioid overdose are now exceeding deaths from shootings.
But maybe we're moving away from manufacturing as we once moved away from agriculture. It seemed impossible, but we did it. This is what the suggestion we've heard in this hour, Jeff.
You know, I think there's a lot of there's a lot of misleading information put around by economists, frankly, like Professor Rogoff, who are defending a conventional economics which can't really explain what's happened. The reality is that manufacturing has been declining since 1945 in the United States at a rate of about 4 to 5% a decade.
Okay,
that's what we saw in the 1980s and 1990s. In the year 2000, globalization truly began with a couple of phenomena, China joining the WTO and Europe agreeing on its Eurozone. Since 2000, in the United States, we have lost 29% of our manufacturing jobs. Unfortunately, Ross Perot proved to be right when he said, if we formed NAFTA, you would hear a giant sucking sound as jobs in the United States went to south to Mexico. That's proved to be right. Now, it's certainly true that automation and technology and the rise in productivity is leading to a slow decline in manufacturing jobs, not just in the United States, but elsewhere in the world. But since 2000, we have seen a tidal wave of jobs leaving the United States because globalization, combined with a fashion for among CEOs to move jobs to low-cost areas, has led to industrial desolation in our heartland. So it's not, you know, you and your colleague and Martin, I'm a fan of the Financial Times. I read it every day, but I read a lot of columns in the Financial Times that talk about different political philosophies as if it's Jackie Kennedy choosing a hat. You have to look at the underlying reality, and the underlying reality is that the economics of globalization has failed the American public just as it's failed the British public.
Let me take that to Martin Wolf. Martin Wolf, what about, you heard Theresa May there, you heard Jeff Ferry, globalization as a disaster.
I think I should separate out various elements of the discussion.
Yes,
first
please.
Of all, it's always difficult to interpret a vote on something like the EU membership, the membership of the European Union. Mm-hmm. But in fact, globalization as such was not an issue in any way, globalization of trade in the Brexit referendum. We, unlike the US, lost most of the jobs in industry in the 1980s under Margaret Thatcher. There hasn't been an acceleration in the rate of decline of jobs in manufacturing. There was a huge adjustment in the 80s, so it's not a new issue. It's absolutely clear that apart from the desire for sovereignty, which was essentially a political motivation, the dominant concern of British voters in Brexit, this is clear from the polls, was migration, immigration, particularly immigration from the European Union, which greatly exceeded what had had been expected. I must say my strong impression from the campaign in the US is that immigration was also a huge issue in the American election campaign.
But hardly alone, though. Well, maybe.
So I don't think this description of what's going on in Europe, certainly in the UK, is in any way correct.
But you had Theresa May herself, she's your prime minister, saying globalization, for many, it means their jobs being outsourced and wages undercut. I mean, that's her line that we just heard.
Yes. Theresa May is making her own interpretation of the events. She has actually, interestingly, no policies to address this and is strongly proposing that as soon as we leave the European Union, we should agree not only a free trade area with the European Union, but agree many more free trade areas with as many more countries as we possibly can. There is absolutely no sign in the policy she's pursuing of trying to roll back trade, rightly so,
for a very open economy
like ours. We have no real choice. We're not like the US. We're not a continental-sized economy. She is very concerned with other policies, which seem to me important ones, that will help people affected by the adjustment process, both of globalization and also technological change, and move us in a more competitive direction. And in our case, that's clearly services.
Jeff, do you see the United States going in a different direction if Theresa May wants to, like, leave the EU but make all kinds of new global deals?
Well, Theresa May is trying to sort out the confusion in the Conservative Party and come up with a policy that can unite people. And as Martin says, she's a little uncertain of where she's taking her country at the moment. What is clear is that globalization, in my mind, it's not just freer trade. It's also a policy which allows wages to fall through increasing competition. Sometimes that's by lowering trade, by lowering borders. Sometimes that's by inviting immigrants in to underbid wages. I mean, Jeff, hold the thought there.
We have to take a short break right here. We'll come right back. Jeff Barry at the Coalition for a Prosperous America, Martin Wolf at the Financial Times in London. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
This podcast and the following message are sponsored by Blue Apron, partnering with sustainable farms, fisheries, and ranchers to deliver all you need to create incredible home-cooked meals. Ingredients come pre-measured, so there's no food waste. Recycle the packaging or mail it back, postage free, and Blue Apron will recycle for you. Rediscover how fun cooking can be. Enjoy seasonally inspired recipes and explore new cuisines. No commitment. Get meals only when you want. Get your first three meals free plus free shipping at blueapron.com/onpoint.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, talking this hour about globalization in the time of President Donald Trump. It can look like globalization in retreat. Donald Trump inaugurated last year to his new presidency last week as the Global Economic Forum was going on in Davos, Switzerland. It's been a big kind of generator of thinking and support for globalization over a long time now. We seem to have come to a new pass. Where do we go from here? What do you think? If borders go up, tariffs, walls, what's that mean for you, for your business? Can Donald Trump renegotiate the world in a way that's good for the United States, good for the world? With Martin Wolf, he's chief economics commentator for the Financial Times in London, joining us via Skype from London. Jeff Ferry is here from San Francisco. He's research director at the Coalition for a Prosperous America. And you can hear, no big fan of globalization when it comes to American jobs. We've got all kinds of news coming out. Donald Trump has signed executive actions on the Keystone Pipeline, the Dakota Access Pipeline that would move toward green lighting those. We'll see where that goes. Talking with American business moguls at the White House yesterday, he talked about incentives that under a Trump administration, American companies would have to stay in the United States.
If you stay here, there's no tax. Somebody would say, oh, Trump is going to tax. I'm not going to tax. There is no tax, none whatsoever. And I just want to tell you, all you have to do is stay. Don't leave. Don't fire your people in the United States. We have the greatest people.
Don't leave. Don't fire your people in the United States. Hardly sounds like a globalizer's view. Not at all. On the other hand, you had Chinese President Xi Jinping in Davos last week, first time ever, at the same moment that Donald Trump is heading toward inauguration, saying, hey, we China, we're all about globalization. We'll drive the global economy.
China's development is an opportunity for the world. China has not only benefited from economic globalization, but also contributed to it. Rapid growth in China has been a sustained and powerful engine for global economic stability and expansion.
Okay, the Chinese president, very happy it sounds like there, ready to step up and be the great globalizer. Steve in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Steve, thank you for calling. You're on the air with Martin Wolf and Jeff Ferry.
Tom, I don't think people who are foes of globalization are isolationists. That's a pejorative. I think what it is that they are skeptical of the 30 years that we've been told that globalization is inevitable and that it is beneficial. And I think we're returning to a healthy skepticism where we look at trade agreements and we look at all of the social baggage that comes with globalization, such as immigration and even losing one's currency and that sort of thing. So I think it's we're not isolationists.
Steve, I appreciate your call. Martin Wolf, do you see a healthy skepticism in the populist economic policies emerging in the U.S. and in your backyard?
I didn't use the word isolationist, and actually I don't think I've ever used it.
Noted, yeah. I think Steve got that
himself. Seems to me to relate to a very different period in history. But I would like to say that it doesn't seem to me true that globalization entails immigration. Korea, for example, South Korea and Japan, both of which have huge trade sectors, basically don't allow any immigration mm-hmm. at all. And giving up your currency, which presumably refers to the creation of the Eurozone, was a very specific and, in my view, I'd never changed my view on this, great, hugely mistaken decision by specific countries. We are, I think, talking very precisely about trade policy. And in this area, I think the caller raises a perfectly good question, which is, should we change our trade policies? What will be the full consequences, taking into account the possible retaliation and other changes in the rest of the world of changing those policies? Would we get huge increases in employment? I don't agree with the numbers we heard earlier. I mean, these are the big questions, but none of the debate that's going on in the US, if I may say so, mm-hmm. has been very informed by that sort of analysis. It's very broad brush rhetoric with very little behind it. And so I think it's quite possible, I'm pretty sure, that fairly mistaken decisions will be made.
You've written just in the last few days, you wrote, policymakers should have paid more attention to what was happening to ordinary citizens. But, you wrote, the simple-minded populism now on the rise will soon prove far worse than the hubris of the Davos elite. What do you mean, Martin?
Well, I think, as I said, that what we are now discussing is taking apart, in the ways I described earlier in this program, the whole structure of agreements, which is a set of global agreements binding well over 100 countries, which has underpinned the development of our economies globally and the development of business. Now, this can't be done by one country on its own without very widespread ramifications. The US cannot consider itself, must not consider itself sensibly to be a sort of island. If it acts in the way that it seems likely to act, with a view to rebalancing the whole of its trade in manufacturing, bringing back, I presume, textile plants and clothing plants and all the rest of it, this will have consequences throughout the world. It will affect other people's trade policies. It will inevitably create lots of bad debt in businesses that are being, and so forth. It has huge ramifications, and those ramifications have to be understood.
Don and Elizabeth,
Tom,
yes,
one
second, Jeff. I just want to get a couple callers in here, and I certainly will come to you. Don in Elizabethtown, Kentucky. Don, you're on the air with Jeff Ferry and Martin Wolf.
Hello, Tom. Yeah, I think as your callers were stating, that the biggest thing that everybody's been missing is the whole consumer portion of this. The United States is the largest, most richest consumer goods buying nation in the world. We always want the latest and greatest thing. You can't even talk to your kids nowadays without buying like $1,500 sneakers.
Yeah,
but we're always
seeing
that.
I don't know about 500. Not my kids, but okay, Don.
I know, right? But I mean, it's just the whole point of we're getting those goods from overseas because of how the trade deals are struck now. Because they're making it for cheaper and they're selling it to us for cheaper. And if we stop doing that, we allow ourselves to do that here in the States, I think we'll be better off. Plus, I mean, if you take a look outside right now, any neighborhood in America, first thing you see are nothing but retail stores. There are no manufacturing things going on out there. It's all about selling. And
do you think it can come back, Don? You're going to have sneaker factories in Elizabethtown, Kentucky?
You know what? I hope so, Tom, because that's what we need. We're still going to buy the latest and greatest things. It's a drug. We've given ourselves this drug for the last 40 years.
Consumerism, okay.
Right. You can't talk to a kid now and give him a normal iPhone. He wants a number 7.
I mean, Jeff Ferry, can you really make that iPhone 7 here in the States anymore? All the factories are in China. All the expertise in that is in China.
Absolutely, you can bring back manufacturing to the United States. You know, there's a very old saying, which is you give a man a fish, you feed him for a day, you teach a man to fish, you feed him for a lifetime. The folks in places like Kentucky and North Carolina were thrilled 25 years ago, when cheap imported textiles and clothing and shoes became available in all the stores in those areas. Mm-hmm. They're less thrilled today because what's happened is all the factories that used to make textiles in North Carolina and places in the industrial heartland have shut down, and those people are now unemployed. So you need a more intelligent economic policy. And, you know, people like Martin talk a bit glibly about globalization as if it's the same thing all over the world. It's not. What's happened in the last 30 years is we've seen certain countries, mostly in Asia, but also including Germany, have strategically decided to bend the trade rules to their advantage. Germany runs a surplus, a trade surplus, worth 8% of its GDP. It does that every single year. And as a result of that, certain other countries, like the United States, are required by the laws of economics and the laws of currency to run a trade deficit. That deficit is hollowing out our economy. We've got to fix that. And then to take it a step further, Germany was worried that this surplus would drive their currency, the Deutschmark, up, which would have allowed the laws of conventional economics to work. It was like a helium balloon moving upward. So what did they do? They took some lead weights called the Eurozone and threw it over their balloon to pull the euro back down so they could continue to run a surplus. We see the same things in China and Korea. Policies that bend the trade rules and break a lot of the trade rules so those countries can run a surplus and move industry to their backyard and away from our backyard.
Martin Wolf, what do you make of that characterization? Martin?
Well, there's one point on which I agree, and since I've written that in a lengthy book on the financial crisis, I'm not going to change that, which is capital flows and current account surpluses and deficits create big macroeconomic problems. So I actually agree with that. But the description of the policies that created this problem are not ones I agree with at all. Indeed, I think the US played quite a large part in all this. So Germany didn't want the Eurozone. It wasn't its idea. It was basically all its neighbors. The Eurozone as a system has partly had the consequences described, but Germany has no policy of generating huge current account surpluses. There's no instructions from the government telling people to save. There's no instruction from the government telling businesses shouldn't invest. Given the conditions of the German economy, aging and all the rest of it, given the Eurozone, this is the economic outcome. One could imagine changing it will be very hard. I think in the case of China, and I wrote this 10 years ago, the description of exchange rate policy was roughly correct until about 8 years ago. But actually, the recent period, there has been a very substantial appreciation of the Chinese currency. There's been an enormous reduction in the current account surplus of China. I mean, really enormous relative to GDP. And most of the time, in the last year or two, the Chinese are actually trying to keep their currency up. If they stopped intervening, the renminbi would actually depreciate. If they got rid of capital controls, there will be a flood of capital out of China and it would depreciate even more. Managing the capital account, which is, I think, the right thing to focus on, not the trade balance, because the trade policy will not determine the trade balance. Managing the capital account in a complex world with very different policies and different structures of the economy and different attitudes to capital account liberalization, that's a really hard thing to do, and nobody's talking about that.
Kent in Wellesley, Massachusetts. Kent, you're on the air.
Hello. Hi, Tom. Kent Jones, Babson College. I just wanted to make this one point further to Martin's comments earlier. Mm-hmm. With Peter Navarro in the White House and Wilbur Ross at Commerce, I firmly believe that Trump's next move, or somewhere down the line, is to propose that the United States actually leave the WTO, the World Trade Organization. Mm-hmm. And then the question becomes, does the World Trade Organization have enough friends in Washington, particularly on Capitol Hill, to prevent that from happening?
Can you see that happening, Martin Wolf? Thank you for calling, Kent. Martin?
I think it would follow logically from the policy they're announcing. In a way, it doesn't matter whether you say you're formally leaving. If you're a member of an institution or a club, let's just find this for a moment as a club, which you created, by the way, which you then say, and you then say, well, as a matter of fact, I want to remain a member of this club. Let's say it's a golf club, but I don't intend to pay any attention to any of the rules that bind this club, members of this club. Then by definition, effective, you've left. Your membership no longer has any meaning.
What consequences?
What do the others then do?
What consequences would you expect if that's the path that the Trump administration takes?
I would expect, if that's really the way they go, that the rest of the world would probably not accept that outcome for themselves. They will continue to be interested in the WTO, and they would say, well, if you've withdrawn, then we have, then all our obligations to you, and they've all entered into obligations to you on their trade policies,
yes,
are null and void. And then we're in trade policy chaos. They can decide to do whatever they want. You can decide what to do whatever you want. And that was precisely the thing that people tried to avoid when the Americans, after the war, decided to create the GATT, which became the WTO.
Can the U.S. come out of that a winner? Can the world come out of that winning?
The U.S. It depends what you mean by winning. The U.S., I think it's quite plausible that the U.S. will be harmed less than others. I have little doubt that the net consequences of that sort of process will be to damage almost everybody. We've experienced that before. In the 30s, it was a big mess.
Jeff Ferry, is that where we're heading here? I mean, people talk
about it. No, I don't see that at all. What I see, frankly, is the U.S. is not going to leave the WTO. The president is going to renegotiate NAFTA. That's going to have an effect on our trade. He's going to renegotiate other trade agreements and maybe renounce some of our bilateral trade agreements, which is a positive thing since we're running deficits with most trade agreement nations. I think the WTO will look at the United States of America and say, my God, this is the world's largest economy. It imports $2.7 trillion worth of goods every year. We don't want them out of our club because they want us in that club so they can keep selling goods to us. And what the president's trying to do is to right the balance a little bit to help American business and American workers both. And he's also trying to do something political. Remember, a lot of Democrats support what President Trump is doing right now, and Trump is trying to remake the political landscape. So I see all this as actually positive developments, and I see something similar happening in Europe. I think you're going to see an Italian election, which is going to lead to the folks who question the euro winning that election. And so bit by bit, globalization gets taken apart because it's failed, because unfair trade agreements are hurting us here in the United States. So these are positive developments. And I think people who make alarmist claims like the world was made perfect in 1945 and that's all falling apart are really backward-looking people. Because, in fact, when Richard Nixon took the dollar off the gold standard in the mid-1970s, not the gold standard, but the gold peg, and when President Reagan attempted and succeeded in renegotiating the value of the dollar in the 1980s, people said exactly the same thing. Oh my God, the United States is leaving the world system that we created perfectly in 1945. And it's not true. The United States needs to have a strong economy, and it's going to take the actions it needs to take.
Martin Wolf, globalization heading into the rearview mirror here?
I think the really interesting question is precisely this. Is it a few tweaks or not? By the way, I supported Nixon going off gold. I was around at the time, and I supported Reagan's policies. I think what we're talking about with Mr. Trump is a completely different ballgame.
This story just getting off the ground, and we will return to it. Wonderful to have you with us today, Martin. Martin Wolf, Chief Economics Commentator at the Financial Times in London. Thank you so much for joining us today, Martin Wolf.
A pleasure. Great pleasure.
And
very
enjoyable. And from San Francisco, Jeff Ferry at the Coalition for a Prosperous America. Thank you very much for being with us, Jeff. We'll talk again.
Thanks, Tom. Appreciate it.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.